Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our White House correspondent joins us to discuss the Nuclear Security Summit. We hear from a journalist charged with spying in Turkey. West African performers bring real-life humor to the stage. And one of the people responsible for turning EDM into a billion-dollar industry is retiring.
Avicii has been plagued with health problems starting in January of 2012, when he was hospitalized for 11 days with acute pancreatitis reportedly brought on by heavy drinking.
It's right here on VOA. U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting his fourth Nuclear Security Summit here in Washington. Delegations from 50 nations are attending. And on the line from the White House is our correspondent, Mary Alice Salinas. Welcome, Mary Alice.
Thank you very much.
Hey, what are they hoping to accomplish this year?
In this series of summits that they've had, the first one in 2010, they have had many countries go ahead and eliminate or ship out nuclear materials. But I think everyone agrees that a lot of work still has to be done. One of the key goals is to secure loose nuclear materials around the world. And there are still many sites, there are still many areas where those materials are not properly secured and vulnerable to theft. And one of the key questions being addressed today is making sure that people like terror groups are not able to get their hands on it, or other people who have some sort of malicious intention. That's a key question moving forward. This is something Obama announced, a series, and what will happen to these kind of nuclear security meetings is still very much in question. That is after he leaves office. So part of what they're doing is to try to get some sort of framework or groups together that will continue addressing nuclear security beyond Obama's presidency.
And Russia's not coming to the party this time.
They are not coming to the party. They just think that the summits have played out. The White House would have liked Russia to attend in a constructive way, according to a White House spokesman. But no, and analysts are saying, look, Russia and U.S. relations are just too tense right now. This is part of that. Russia also does not like this is the U.S.'s baby. You know, Obama started this series of summits, and they prefer a more international, broad sort of architecture for these kinds of things. So they're just not making it this time around. And that's a disappointment here at the White House, and it's important because Russia is such a key player, although they have to work together on many nuclear security issues like the Iran nuclear deal.
In the end, when this is all wrapped up, are we expecting a final statement or a final declaration?
Yes. Typically, they have done that. In this case, they're going to work out some nitty-gritty details. They will express their commitments they have had at this meeting, the progress that has been made. They will have an action plan with a list of multiple items that they're going to be, you know, going back to the countries and accomplishing. And so will there be anything huge out of it? I don't think so. Just more follow-through on some of the commitments that have been made, maybe some more commitments. It's going to be very detailed. But the key question moving forward is, what's next? How will the world, how will the international community continue to address the question of nuclear security?
Well, thank you, Mary Alice, over at the White House.
Thank you, Susan.
It's time to take a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story. And joining me at this time, as he usually does, is my social media reporter and friend, Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew, once again.
Thank you for having me, as always.
A little enthusiastic today.
Yes. Getting close to the end of the week so
That's
we can be
right.
enthusiastic. So.
What you got going?
Well, this nuclear summit that we've been talking about, Google Trends tweeted out their list of the top countries searching for the term nuclear summit in the week preceding. Some interesting countries on here. Number one is the Czech Republic. They're the ones that are searching the most. Number two is Denmark, followed by South Korea, Norway, and number five is the United States, of course, where the summit is being held here in D.C.
An interesting follow-up would be to study why those particular countries are at the top of that list, you know?
And I have no doubt there are policy experts that are looking into that as we speak.
But, you know, we haven't seen as many private tweets from participants at these at the conference.
Yeah, and that, I think, speaks to the kind of secrecy of some of these negotiations or the fragility of some of these negotiations. I think either they have a self-imposed embargo or they've been told, stay off social media, we don't want to jeopardize any of these deals that are going on, or we don't want to tip our hand as to what we're doing. But I have no doubt that after these deals come to fruition or don't come to fruition, we're going to see a lot of people maybe doing damage control or promotion, and we're going to see a lot of the analysts talking about what these deals mean or what they don't mean if they don't happen. So it'll be interesting to see that as it unfolds.
You got something else for me today?
Yeah, sad news that Zaha Hadid, famous Iraqi-British architect, has died at the age of 65 of a heart attack.
It's not very old.
No, and she was sick with bronchitis and then was in the hospital and died, but was the first woman to win the Pritzker Prize, which is the highest architecture design prize, known perhaps best for the 2012 Summer Olympic Games, the aquatics venue in London. She designed that, but a number of other famous buildings around the world. So she's a top trending topic as people are sharing photos of some of her most famous buildings and saying what beautiful work that she did. So a great way to commemorate her life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Since 1988, astronomers have found over 2,000 exoplanets, or planets, outside of our solar system. To help spot these planets, scientists have used a number of technologies, such as the Kepler Space Telescope. Now, NASA is moving on to an even newer and more sophisticated instrument for planet hunting. This new cutting-edge device is called NEAD, short for NN Explore Exoplanet Investigations with Doppler Spectroscopy. The instrument will spot the extrasolar planets by measuring the tiny wobbling of stars. NEAD is part of a planned planet-searching partnership between the Space Agency and the National Science Foundation. The device will be built by Penn State researchers and is expected to be completed in 2019. It will be installed on a telescope at the Kitt Peak National Observatory in Arizona. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Two of Turkey's leading journalists, Can Dündar and Erdem Gül, are on trial on spying charges for reporting that the government was shipping arms to Islamists in Syria. The case has provoked alarm among Turkey's Western allies and human rights groups over press freedom in Turkey. Turkey President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has repeatedly intervened in the case, saying the journalists will be severely punished. If convicted on espionage charges, they face 30 years behind bars. Kadri Gürsel of the Al Monitor website says the reports embarrass the president and his government, especially the release of police video showing the interception of an alleged arms shipment escorted by intelligence agents to jihadists in Syria. Both the United States and the European Union have voiced alarm over the case. Reporter Dorian Jones asked journalist Can Dündar if, when he wrote the story about arms smuggling, if he knew how controversial it would be.
Yeah, our lawyers warned us about that, about the consequences, possible consequences of such a news item. Normally, legally, we were right, and professionally, we were right. And the story was a true story, and we have the public interest in publishing it. But since the Turkish government was so oppressed with the story, our lawyers warned us about a possible harassment. And we knew that, let's say.
I mean, you were imprisoned. Was it a shock? And how hard was it to be imprisoned? And did you reconsider the decision of publishing it?
Of course, let's say not shock, but surprising for me, because my first imprisonment was this was. So, but since this is Turkey, and the prison is a kind of house for Turkish writers and journalists. Turkey has been a house for Turkish journalists and writers. So it's a kind of career planning. I mean, you graduated from the school and you start working as a journalist, then you can be jailed. So it's a normal procedure in a way. Of course, surprising, but I don't feel shocked or so. I mean, it was a normal step for a journalist in Turkey if you are seeking the truth.
But it must have been very difficult.
Well, it depends on what you are expecting from such a imprisonment. The worst part was solitary confinement, really. I mean, they keep you 24 hours all alone, and of course they are pushing for a kind of loneliness But ironically, I was not alone with those supports, and people were coming in front of the prison, and my lawyers and some parliaments always visited me. So and they asked me to stop writing, but I wrote much more than I was in outside the jail, and I read a lot. So I published a book afterwards, and it was a very fruitful time period for me.
Do you ever regret wishing maybe you shouldn't have published this story?
Not at all. I mean, never regret it, because it was a very strong story, and it was a crime, an international crime for Turkish government and the president and Turkish intelligence services, trafficking arms towards the neighboring country and to get involved in civil war there. And that's why, as a journalist, it was my responsibility to publish it.
Turkish journalist Can Dündar speaking with reporter Dorian Jones. Coming up on International Edition, two comedians bring real life to the stage. And Avicii is retiring. Storytelling and stand-up comedy are experiencing a renaissance in West Africa. The African Performing Arts Jamboree Massa in Abidjan this month showcased the talents of two performers who draw on their personal histories to produce dazzling one-woman shows. Bram Pastumas has their stories from Abidjan.
They are from West Africa. They both have wildly successful one-woman shows. And they are carving out their own niche in the theatre world, on and off the continent.
Bonjour à tous, je m'appelle Amou Tati, Tatiana Rojo.
Tatiana Rojo says she is from Ivory Coast and she works in the theatre and as a comedian. She has also been in 10 films since moving to France at age 19. Both Rojo and Burkina Faso native Rukyata Ouédraogo took the stage at the Abidjan Performing Arts Festival.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Rukyata Ouédraogo, comédienne, dramaturge.
Before the theatre, Ouédraogo did all kinds of different jobs to pay the rent. And then,
je suis allée faire un stage au Cours Florent, donc à Paris, et j'ai eu.
She says she wanted to try something new and did an internship at a theatre in Paris. She says her teachers encouraged her, even though back in Burkina Faso, the theatre didn't interest her at all. Tatiana Roja was always acting in other people's films, but then she decided she wanted to talk about her own life.
Avoir un spectacle comme ça au début, on a beaucoup de portes qui se ferment.
She says many doors slammed shut because she wanted to show the life of an unknown woman from Africa, someone like her mother. Nobody cared, she said. We had nowhere to perform. But then her stage director, Eric Checo, said, you know what? We're going to have your mother tell her story from a big, classic Louis XVIII royal French chair. And so was born her one-woman show, Dame de Fer, or Iron Lady. The antique chair is one of the few props she uses on stage. Her mother sold cassava in an Abidjan market. Around her, Tatiana Rojo creates a quasi-fictional universe of characters, including four complicated daughters and their lovers. She says it was a lot of work putting the storyline together. We worked for months on the characters and their psychologies. And it all fits together beautifully. Rukyata Ouédraogo puts her own life on stage in her show Ouagadougou Pressé, which translates to Ouagadougou in a Hurry. She says she wanted to talk about immigration because she is one of those migrants. And yes, often it's sad. People leave their homes, find themselves not wanted, or don't even make it. She says she wanted to show the comeback, the joy when you see your relatives again. And around that idea, she says, she created all these little stories. And so the show takes us from a schoolgirl slipping away from her stern father to attend a party, and then on to a beauty salon, in Paris, of course.
Vous êtes perdu! Ah, c'est
Both shows are funny, but aside from the many jokes, there are some serious points being made.
C'est aussi une Afrique qui se bat, une Afrique d'aujourd'hui. Donc c'est ce message.
Rojo says her show, Dame de Fer, is about an Africa that fights. The mother marries off her girls because she needs to pay the rent and the bulldozer is on its way. Rojo says Africa sends its children abroad, but people have always moved around the world, and so Africa is no different. Ouédraogo is out to change the theatre.
Je parle effectivement de ça dans ma pièce, de mon combat.
She says she wants decent roles for black actors. It's always a cleaning woman, she says, or a nurse who works as an illegal migrant, or a prostitute. She says she's had it with all that. She refuses roles now because she has her own productions. Ouédraogo based her very first production on the life of Yenenga, the fierce, legendary princess from what is now Burkina Faso. And both women gave their shows in Abidjan a distinctly Ivorian flair with a little Zouglou.
Le chien ne change jamais sa manière de s'asseoir. C'est qui ça? Kolo Kanga.
If you are in New York, keep an eye out for the debut of the English version of Tatiana Rojo's Iron Lady. And Rukyata Ouédraogo performs her newest production, Tombe la Masque, or Drop the Mask, at the Buffon Theatre in Paris throughout April. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Abidjan.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
Will virtual reality be the next new world in high-tech gaming? Yes, if Oculus gets its way. Oculus recently released its much-anticipated virtual reality system, the Oculus Rift. Palmer Luckey designed the first Rift headset in his mother's garage.
Put it on and it actually feels like you're in this virtual space, like you've left the real world entirely.
Palmer sold the Oculus to Facebook for $2 billion a couple of years ago. Now Facebook's VR system is on the market for a hefty $600. $600 for the headset and related gear is not all you'll need. You'll also need a powerful Windows PC. Peter Brown is editor of the video gaming website, GameSpot.
The Oculus Rift is powered by a high-end gaming PC. It requires something that costs at least around $1,000.
So if you have an older PC, you may have to upgrade. And remember, Google's Cardboard VR headset is only $15. Also remember, you get what you pay for. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
Fans of electronic dance music, or EDM, were shocked to learn that Swedish DJ Avicii is retiring at age 26. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, one of the people responsible for turning EDM into a billion-dollar industry says 2016 will be his last year touring.
So wake me up when it's all over.
Best known for his 2014 smash hit Wake Me Up, Avicii, born Tim Berling in Sweden, said that this would be his last year on the road. In a lengthy letter posted on his Facebook page, the 26-year-old told fans that a recent trip across the United States with some friends helped him to see things in a new way. He said the trip helped him realize it was time to step away from touring. Avicii has been plagued with health problems starting in January of 2012 when he was hospitalized for 11 days with acute pancreatitis reportedly brought on by heavy drinking. The condition flared again in 2013 and he had to cancel several live shows and was hospitalized again in Australia. In 2014, Avicii was forced to cancel a series of performances in Miami because of illness and had to have surgery to remove a burst appendix and his gallbladder. The Swedish-born DJ told the Associated Press that the time he had to take off from touring helped him realize that a life change was needed.
Went to the studio and I did that, and I was like 20 kilos thinner, and I was like, I look like a skeleton and like still jumping into the studio, you know. But then I kind of realized that I just had to take some time and just focus on me and just kind of getting back in shape, getting back in like both physically and mentally, and, you know, try to set up a long-term plan for all of this, which is, I think, what we did.
Hey, brother, there's an endless road to rediscover. Hey, sister.
In his letter to fans, Avicii did not say that his health was the main reason for his retirement. He said his choices and career have never been driven by material things, but he is grateful for his success. He also spent a lot of time thanking people, especially his fans. Avicii told the AP that after taking some time off, he feels restored, even better than he felt before he started touring.
If I look back to me before I started touring, you know, I feel better now, which is weird to me. That's all thanks to, like, exercise and to all the people around me who's, like, really helped me out a lot. I'm addicted to you!
In his letter, Avicii said that he will never let go of music. He will continue to speak to my fans through it. He also hinted at a possible return, saying, I could be back, but I won't be right back. And in a unique turn, the DJ said he has a new phone and gave fans the number to text him about all this. However, he did ask fans to bear with him because I might not be super quick to reply. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than 70 people were killed and more than 300 injured in a suicide bombing in a crowded park in Lahore, Pakistan, on Easter Sunday. Most of those killed were women and children. State Department spokesperson John Kirby condemned in the strongest terms the appalling terrorist attack in the eastern province of Punjab. Jamaat-ul-Ahrar, a splinter group of the Pakistani Taliban, has claimed responsibility for the attack, which they say was directed at Pakistani Christians. Though in the aftermath, it has become clear more Muslims than Christians lost their lives in the attack. Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif vowed to eradicate extremist ideologies from Pakistan after the Easter Sunday bombing. Our goal is not only to eliminate terror infrastructure, but also the extremist mindset, which is a threat to our way of life, Sharif said in a statement. We must take this war to the doors of the terrorist outfits before they are able to hit our innocent countrymen. Jamaat-ul-Ahrar has claimed responsibility for several big attacks in the past 2 years. It has previously carried out at least 2 major attacks in Lahore, one in 2015 that targeted 2 Christian churches, and another at the Wagah border between India and Pakistan in late 2014. Of Pakistan's 190 million people, approximately 1.5% of the total population is Christian, according to the latest census. But it is a community that has been targeted by extremist groups before. For example, in 2013, a suicide bombing at a church in Peshawar left more than 100 people dead, and a series of attacks at churches in Lahore left 14 dead. Attacks like these only deepen our shared resolve to defeat terrorism around the world, said spokesperson Kirby. And we will continue to work with our partners in Pakistan and across the region to combat the threat of terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.